Okay.
Lou, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Okay.
I'm here.
All right, we're live, Lou. So I found Lou. We got Lou back. Lou, I already introduced the show and welcomed everybody. And so Lou Eisenbrandt is my guest tonight. And Lou, so this is how I met Lou. So last April of 2016, I know it was that date because that's what you wrote in the book the book that I bought you that night of yours. And I was at this veterans event doing veterans music, and they invited all these people from different wars and different ages and to come up and play three or four songs that were important to them. And Lou, they came up and they introduced her as an army nurse from Vietnam, and she played some really good songs. I don't remember what they were, classic 60s. And I thought, that's an interesting gal. And, you know, she's nice looking and articulate and charming, and she did a really good job of speaking and everything and played some great songs. And afterwards, she had a table, and I saw she was selling books. And the cover really connected with me. I thought, well, that's a picture of a really cute kid, this Army nurse. It was her when she was in Vietnam. And I thought, well, I'm going to buy it. What the hell? So I bought it, stuck it in my bag, and didn't actually read it till around Christmas time in the gym, and it took me about 3 days, and I thought, holy smokes, this is a great book. I got to get Lou on my show. So I contacted her, we had coffee, and here is Lou. So, Lou, let's talk first about the book, why you wrote it, and how long, the little process about that, and then we'll get to talking about what's in the book, about your experience going to Vietnam while you were there and afterwards. So, talking about the book, when did you start reading it and writing it, and why?
I really started I started the process many years ago because I kept a journal while I was a nurse during the year 1969 through 1970. And having kept the journal, I really kept it for my own benefit as well as for posterity, thinking, you know, I would someday maybe turn this into something for my family. But I really didn't have any serious intentions at that time. But as the years went by and I was speaking to a lot of students and other groups, several friends said, you know, you really ought to write a book. And a couple people in particular really kept nudging me. And finally I thought, well, maybe this is a good idea, because if I just leave all this random, the documents and the photos and everything else, and it's not in some sort of form where it's all put together, you know, when I'm no longer around, they're going to, you know, perhaps my children and grandchildren are going to say, what was mother thinking? We've got all these papers and things we don't know what to do with. So at that point I thought, well, maybe I will go ahead and write a book. And a friend of mine who had been urging me to do that, if you do that, I know a publisher who will publish your book. And I said, well, fine. He said, can I give him your name? I said, okay. Sure enough, the guy calls me the next morning and says, I understand you're writing a book. And I said, well, I guess I am now. So that's how the book came about. And fortunately, like I said, I'd kept a journal, I had lots of photographs, and I'd been speaking about it for many years, so it wasn't that difficult to put it all together into a book form. I had no idea that it would become as popular as it has, and I'm most grateful, because I think it's important to keep the story of Vietnam alive and well.
Right, and this book, I mean, it's a really good book. It's not that long. It's not even 200 pages. But it's got great photographs. It's got photocopies of some crucial orders. It's got some really nice poems. One in particular, the one I like is in the beginning. And it's written in a style and voice that is very accessible to a wide audience. You know, it's not written in militaries. It's written by somebody who, this would be a very accessible book for a civilian audience, for a non-military audience, right? So,
And that was the purpose, because I think many books that are written, and perhaps more by men rather than women, because there weren't as many of us there in Vietnam as there were GIs, obviously, but the guys are more, tell more their story of what they were up to, which is more about
right.
Bullets and ammo and, you know, and up
right.
the hill and down the hill and that sort of thing. And that's not what my part of Vietnam was all about.
Right, right. Indeed. And you have, and this book it's a very good telling of what you went through. And it's a very good, I think just about any nurse, not just Vietnam nurses, even a nurse today could really connect with your book. And I'm sure they could see a lot of similarities. So And actually, let me read one thing. This is from a friend of mine today. I sent an invitation about this podcast, and I think he's going to listen, but his name is Dick, and Dick was in Vietnam with Special Forces, and he said, "Mother, please tell Lou I apologize for the way I treated all the nurses during one of my too many stays in one of the Saigon area field hospitals. I was bored and wanted to get back to my team. I apologize to all the nurses I harassed that night. They were great while I was an ass." So, and actually, I got a few emails like that. And a lot of, you know, in Facebook and emails of guys just saying, "Oh, my God, thank God for all the nurses." So let me set the stage here just for everybody for whom, for all of our vets and all of our people who for whom dates are important. So you entered the Army in May of 67, 20 years old. You reported to Fort Sam in Texas for your pre-Vietnam, what they call now pre-deployment training, November of 68. You spent some time at Fort Dix, arrived there in January of 69. And you arrived in Vietnam, landing at the Ben Hoa airfield on 1 November 1969. And well, like a week or something like that later, you went to Chu Lai, which was in the I Corps region in the north, with the 91st Evac Hospital. And there you were there from until you got back and on U.S. soil. You landed at SeaTac, Seattle-Tacoma Airport, on 10 October 1970. So let's go back to arriving in Vietnam, landing on Ben Hoa. Tell us about that first experience when you're arriving in Vietnam. Tell us about that.
Well, needless to say, I had no idea, I guess, what I was getting into. I probably had an inkling of it, but I joined the Army to see the world, and I obviously got more than I bargained for. but landing, I can still remember walking off the plane, and I flew in actually on, not a plug, but I flew in on an American Airlines plane, and there were 13 women on board and the rest were men. And I remember opening the door and walking out into this blast furnace of heat, probably at least 100 degrees and maybe in excess of that, and looking around and thinking, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? I was wearing my green cords, which were, you know, I would describe as dressy outfit, and we were issued fatigues, things of that sort. And I spent 4 days down in Long Bend after landing at Ben Hoa, and I remember them saying to me, "Where do you want to go?" And I thought, how the heck do I know where I want to go? I don't know anything about Vietnam. They would drive us to the airport at 2 a.m. to take us wherever we were supposed to go. And then they changed their mind. And then we would come back to the barracks basically and stay there. But finally, when I had a friend who had been stationed in the 91st at Chu Lai. So I said, well, at least I'd know one person when I got there, but it was quite the shock. There were obviously no facilities for women, as in latrine facilities. We used to have one of the men go in and clear the place out so the ladies could come and use the latrines. And it was just a very, very strange introduction to a country I knew next to nothing about, but knew that it was going to be an adventure, and that it was.
You know, and I think a lot of veterans, regardless of their branch, their MOS, their rank, whatever, when you talk about, you had no idea what you got a lot more than you bargained for. I think most veterans would agree with that, especially younger troops on their first deployment. In Vietnam, they say tour, now they say deployment. But I think that's a common experience, is people thinking, holy crap, this isn't like the movies, this isn't like video games. So, So you got to Chu Lai, and tell us about Chu Lai. And I think you spent a few months first in a medical ward before you moved to the emergency room, and that's when things got serious, right?
Yes. I was assigned to the hospital was a, unlike MASH, which were tents, movable, they were metal Quonset huts, so it really wasn't a movable hospital. But each of the wards, we had the regular wards you would have in a civilian hospital, intensive care, surgery, post-surgical things. But we had wards that were set up for guys who had issues with something that was not a wound. It was not a war injury. In other words, malaria, which was rampant because of the mosquitoes and the climate, hepatitis, which was very common due to drinking dirty contaminated water or eating bad food, intestinal parasites, and probably more common than anything was jungle rot, which is what you get when you wear combat boots for days on end and they get wet and you can't dry them out and you get big sores on your feet and legs, which get infected. And so you need to come in out of the bush for a while till they're healed and they're treated, and then they go back. So that's what I basically did for 3.5 months. I also had one gentleman who had a heart attack, and so I took care of him while he was recovering from his heart attack. Basically what the medical units were all about. And after 3.5 months, I was invited by the chief nurse, who happened to be a man, which was kind of interesting, I was asked if I would like to make the move down to the emergency room, and I accepted the challenge. And that's when I really did some phenomenal nursing for the next 8.5 months.
So I want to read something here from your book on page 27. It is taken from that journal, and thank God you kept that journal so you could write this book and share it with your family. And I think a lot of people write books so they can pass things on to their family. Well, you pass this on to a much broader audience than your family. But so it says, and you got this from the journal, and that you say the entries, this entry says, insane day with 20-plus GIs, burns, frag wounds, triple amps, DOA and KIA, absolutely makes me sick. Or mass cal at 18, this is another entry, mass cal, mass casualties, at 1815, yes, which is 615, 52 patients altogether, 16 at 1100, filled the pages of my journal, blah, 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 blah. So what are some of the, when you think back, what are some of the solid memories and feelings you get from some of that?
Well, they're always, there are always days and in some cases actually even patients that stand out. I remember my first day in the emergency room, the first patient, first wounded gentleman we got in was a bilateral amputee. One of his legs was missing about the knee, and the other one was dangling and obviously couldn't be saved. You grow up in a hurry. You realize in a big hurry, you have to suck it up, as it were, and keep at it because you're no good to anyone if you fall apart. And So those things stay in your mind. The other things are days when I remember seeing my first triple amputee, and my thought was, this poor kid, and most of them were kids. Most of them were 18, 19 years old. And thinking, you know, we've saved his life, but what kind of a life is that going to be? And then there were other days. I remember when the VC hit a Vietnamese village, and we got 99 casualties in a 24-hour period. And it challenges your skills as well as your composure, keeping it together. And obviously, most of us did not speak Vietnamese, so we did have some interpreters, but it's difficult to answer pleas and cries for help when you have one interpreter and there are, you know, so many patients that you have to deal with.
Right.
Another gentleman that I will never forget was a young man who came in, and the first thing we did when we got patients in the emergency room was to cut off all their clothes because there was no way to assess, particularly frag wounds. You know, a tiny piece of metal doesn't do much harm if it hits you in a thigh, but if it hits you in your neck, it's much more serious. So we would cut the clothes off and then roll the patients over. They were on a litter, so to check the backside to see, you know, how bad it was. And we literally started to roll him over, and his back stayed on the litter. And I will never forget him because he lived to go into the OR and to be evac out to Japan. But I think about him almost every day and wonder whether his name is now on the wall in D.C. or whether he actually survived, because he certainly was one of the more seriously wounded of the patients that we saw. And head wounds, you know, massive head wounds, gunshot, things of that sort. Many of them did not make it. And if that was, if we knew that there was no chance for him to survive, one of the nurses would sit and hold his hand and talk to him until he died. Those are things you don't forget easily.
Right. You know, and I read in your book, somewhere in your book, and I can't find it right now, but you talk about how going to the wall and looking at the wall, and I don't remember what year you first went to the Vietnam War Memorial, to the wall, and walking mm-hmm. along that wall and looking at all those names and thinking, I probably touched some of those guys on this wall.
Mm-hmm. I think about that every time I go, and I wonder how many, you know, passed through the hospital, how many I actually touched, you know, held their hand or said to them, you're going to be okay, when I wasn't sure that they were. That is, and there's no way I will ever know. There's nobody that I know
right.
personally. Now, there was a nurse. There are 8 women on the wall, and the one nurse who was killed by direct enemy fire was actually killed at my hospital about 5 months before I got there. And her name was Sharon Lane, and I never met Sharon, but I feel like I know her just because she was at my hospital. And I do always stop and you know, either do a rubbing or at least touch her name when I'm visiting.
Wow. Hey, by the way, I see that your husband's on and he's just listening. If we can put him on at some point if he wants to talk. That'd be okay.
I don't know if he wants to talk or not.
That's up to him. That's up to you too. That's up to you too. But he's fine where he is too, where he can just listen. So, and also for all of our listeners out there now, feel free to call in. The guest call-in line is area code 646-716-8075. Or you can, from our website, or there's various different applications you could be listening in on phones and laptops. Feel free to text in the questions for Lou to answer, or just a comment or say thank you or whatever, or hi. Again, the call-in number is area code 646-716-8075. Okay, so before we move on, I want to read just a little bit of this poem, Remember, at the beginning of your book. Now, did you write this?
Yes. And
you
I wrote all the poetry that's in the book. And not a long time ago. I mean, I wrote it 4 or 5 years ago, maybe.
Okay. Well, a lot of writers do that. It has time. Experiences and feelings and emotions and words need time to percolate and to mature.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the book. This is the poem, Remember, at the beginning. I don't think, well, we had a friend of mine on who's a poet a couple months ago. But anyways, this is the poem, Remember, written by Lou. Remember the sounds of death, the gurgle of a last breath. Remember helicopter blades, wop, 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 bringing bloodied and broken bodies. Remember the acrid odor of burning flesh and the peeling skin from white phosphorus. Remember rain, rain, and yet more rain. Remember the whistle of rockets splashing in the sea where earlier that day we had skied. Remember sand, coconut oil, guitars, and music. Remember shoulders wet from tears, blood dripping on our boots, body bags cradling the silent contents. Remember escaping into scotch and cigarettes, writing, loving, filming, laughing. Remember leaving whole when so many were broken. Remember and share whenever you can so that others may never forget. And that is a great poem.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that I wanted to read that too because that captures so much, not just the casualties and the ER and all of that, but also sand, coconut oil, guitar, shoulders wet with tears. So let's get into and talk about wait a minute, do I have a caller? Let me see. Okay, I got a question. I want to talk about time off and how you coped, but right now I have a question. This is from Frank Falafel, and he says, have you had any contact with any soldiers you were able to save? I think you kind of already touched on that.
Yes, I really have not had any personal contact with guys that I actually met while I was there. I have, since the book came out, I've been contacted by about three or four GIs who say they were either visiting the had troops, you know, that they brought in with them to the 91st, or they themselves were there. Like I said, unless we exchange names, it's very difficult, unless somebody specifically would remember exact dates
right.
that they were there. And still, there were usually during the day, there were at least two nurses, maybe three on. So even if you came in at that very time, it could be one of the other nurses took care. So I really have not,
right.
I've not found anybody who's definitely can say, you know, I went through your hospital while you were there.
It, great. And that's an excellent answer. And that, I think that's the most case. Even with civilian ORs, I mean, a lot of that, there's a lot of the same dynamics that happen. A lot of the time doctors, especially nurses, want to know what happened to somebody and they just can't find out or they just don't allow themselves to. I got a
right.
caller now, and it's a friend of mine, Ron Piper. So let's bring Ron
Hello,
Piper.
Ron.
Are you there?
Yes, sir. How you
Ron.
Doing, Mother?
Ron
hey, listen,
Piper, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great.
Go ahead.
Listen, this is outstanding, and I just don't want to take up a lot of time. But, Lou, I my hat's off to you, darling. I was a recipient from the gals down at 36 EVAC in 3 Corps in late 68.
Yes.
And if not for them, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. So God bless you, and thank you very much. And I will. I'm going to get your book, by the way. So. Again, thank you.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that very much.
Okay.
Hoorah,
all
right, Ron.
You guys take care.
All right. Hoorah, Ron. Thanks, man. And we got another caller here. Let's bring this person on. I didn't have a name. So we got another caller. Caller, are you there?
I am Christ calling in. Hello?
Yes.
Again?
This is Jennifer Crist calling in.
Oh, Jennifer Crist.
Yeah, Jennifer.
Hey, Jen.
How's it
How
going?
You doing, babe? All right.
I'm good.
So, Lou.
Go ahead,
Jen. Go.
Hey, Lou. This is Jennifer Crist. You don't know me, but first of all, I want to thank you for your service.
Thank you.
To our country. And I happen to be the daughter of an internal medicine physician that was stationed in your exact same spot in July from 1969 to 1970. And he doesn't know that he met you because apparently you were working in the ER.
Wait a
yes.
minute. Tall, reddish blonde hair?
That's Bob. Right. Robert Crist. He is listening right now. He's
oh
listening,
gosh,
but he was too shy to call in, and I had to do it.
I have a picture of him walking down the sidewalk from, actually, I think I was headed to the ER, and he was headed the other direction. Oh, my gosh,
oh,
I can't
so
believe
funny.
It.
So you're aware of who he was or is. Yes.
Absolutely. I've got great photos of him.
Fantastic. Well,
oh
I know he would love to say, I know he would love to say hi to you, but he was. A little bit, I think, shy to call in, but they are listening, my mother and father right now. And he wanted me.
He couldn't be shy, could he?
No, he was pretty outgoing, kind of that tall drink of water that he still is.
Yeah.
But I know that he would like me to tell you how much your book moved him. Because he was able to look through all the pictures and see where his hooch was and remembering all of those aerial views. And so he was just couldn't believe that a book was written by someone who had actually been where he was at the same time and also involved in the medical field. So thanks again. And I just wanted to say hi.
I am so touched. I hope he has my email because I will send him pictures I have of him.
Oh, that would be great. You know what? I can give you offline maybe an email address. And is your email in the book? No.
If a bookmark came with it, there's an email address. If not, certainly Jeff has it, and we can make sure that we get it to him.
Wonderful.
We can get you guys.
Thanks so much.
You're both on Facebook. You're both on Facebook.
Okay, that's good to know as well. So thank you again, Lou. Take care.
Hey, Jen. Jen.
Yeah.
Jen.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for calling in, babe.
You bet. Take care.
All right.
Lou, hey,
take
Jeff.
Care. Who's this?
I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me, Jeff?
Is this Bob?
It is. It
hey,
is.
Bob.
I was on the line when Jennifer called in, and somehow I got her on this line, too. And I wanted to thank you for doing this, Jeff, and to
my pleasure.
Be sure to it's just a wonderful thing knowing that we're having this experience. You know, I have lots of things to think about and talk about, but I most of all want to just, and I'm not going to take any time other than to just thank you for doing this. And I remember Lou so well. I remember particularly the experience that I had. I wanted to tell you, Lou, that we enjoyed very much that book. We've distributed your book to a number of individuals, mostly in our family, but in addition to our family. And it brought back great memories. You made it very good for all of us to touch bases with you and to reach back and remember that again. And I enjoyed the photographs in the book immensely, because it served as a modem to remember what our hooch looked like, you know, and all of the places where we stayed, and of course the medical ward. I served in the medical ward there, and in internal medicine largely, along with Dan McMartin and a few other people there. And Lou, thank you, and Jeff, thank you very much for the experience. We appreciate your efforts there and letting us know about it. Yeah.
It's my pleasure, Bob.
And we will stay in touch, Bob.
All right. Appreciate that. Thanks, Lou, very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Bob. Take care, Bob.
All right. Appreciate that. Thanks, Lou, very much.
Okay. Lou, you're still there, right?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm still in a state of shock. That is so cool. That is so cool. Yeah, we definitely need to stay in touch.
So I have known the Chris since I was a little baby, a little kid. Jennifer was a few months older than me, and Bob and my dad went through medical training together, and so Jennifer, literally as babies, we were like sharing baths together and stuff like that. So I've known Bob and Jan, his wife, and Jennifer and her brother and her sister my whole life. And I remember when he was in Vietnam, my dad was in the Navy, and I remember that time when he was gone over in Vietnam and the stress and the tension and I think Jan was much more, it was much more palatable. She did a good job of hiding it, because I don't know if Jennifer and the other two kids, Bobby and Carolyn, I don't think they caught on because they were too young, but I don't think Jennifer, I don't know, it'd be interesting to talk to her because it's hard to know what kids experience when their parents are gone.
Right.
To war. So anyways, so that's interesting. So let's use that and talk about the relationships that you form. So you're in this highly stressful environment, and it's not just the constant casualties coming in, but it's also the risk because, occasionally the VC, the Viet Cong, they lob mortars or rockets or something in. That one nurse got killed a few months before you got there. So there's risk. It's a combat zone. It's guerrilla war, and there's not really too many semblances of front lines. There were no front lines. So what kind of relationships did you form? And also maybe even talk about what did you do on your time off? What did you do to relax and cope? How did you cope with all this, with being there? How did you cope? And the relationships your book makes pretty clear help to cope. So talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a combination of things. In terms of relationships, I think that when I speak and do my PowerPoint presentation, I have a picture of four guys, and one of them has a plunger on his head with a white flag, and he was new, and so the other guys were reading the rules of the hospital off of a roll of toilet paper. Now, this may sound totally stupid to other people, but We had to make our own fun and get our own comic relief. You couldn't dwell day and night on what you were doing. You had to have some way of forgetting for it, even if it was just a couple hours. And obviously alcohol played a little bit of a role in that. Well, maybe more than a little bit of a role in that. But you simply had to make your own fun and do what you could do to forget the war for a brief period of time. And you struck up very close relationships with everybody. I mean, there's certainly some people more so with one or two individuals than a whole group. But I try to describe it when I speak to children, not youngsters, but high school kids. And I say, you know, like if you go away to summer camp or you go away for a year somewhere, study abroad, and you make really close friends, and then it's time to leave. And you have such mixed feelings because you're thrilled that you've survived and you're coming home with all your limbs and, you know, you've made it through. But at the same time, it was very difficult to leave because these had become very, very close friends. And I think that the fact that you develop those relationships, it has a lot to do with just survival, you know, just getting together, whether it was the officers' club or was some other place or location or something that you did, you simply had to do escapism. There weren't videos. There wasn't even Skype and, you know, email and all the things that exist now. There was the U.S. mail, and sometimes it was a couple of weeks before you get a letter from somebody. So you really got very close to the people that you were working with.
Right. And, you know, I even recall a lot of families used a cassette tape, and they would send cassette tapes back and forth in the mail. And that was, I think a lot of families did that. But even then, it was the mail. It traveled through the mail.
Right. And they actually, just a slight correction, they weren't cassettes. They were reel-to-reel little bitty tapes, and they would account for about 30 minutes of conversation, and you put them in a white plastic thing, and then my parents had a little recorder and I had a little recorder, and that's how we communicated. Unfortunately, my dear sainted mother let my baby brother tape music over all those that I sent her, so I that resource for reliving things unfortunately got lost, but it's okay, Mom, I forgive you.
Okay, well, tell us about, in your book, you talk about actually going out in a helicopter with some group of guys. I don't know if they're USO or actually an Army, some kind of Army band or something. You talk about the LZ, and you landed in an LZ where I think it was like an infantry unit or company probably had pulled back, and they were doing a little R&R for like probably a day, maybe two, and these helicopters brought in Wow, and they brought in some guys playing in a band, and you mm-hmm. tagged along. So what was that like?
Well, it was another chance to see a different part of the country rather than just the hospital. If I recall correctly, there were five or six guys who were musicians. They were musicians before they joined the Army, and their MOS was to be a musician, and they formed a band, which I love it. It was called the Joint Chiefs of Staff was the name of the band, which I thought was very funny. And they would go around from one LZ to another landing zone, for those of you who aren't familiar with that term, which is basically an area that was cleared, thanks to Agent Orange, of most of the foliage. So it was a place that I describe it as a wide spot in the road. And a few tents were set up, and the guys would come in from the bush, you know, some of them once a week, some of them more often, sometimes less. And it was just an escape from being out in the middle of the swampy, you know, water and heat and all the rest of it. They could get a meal other than just their, you know, little canned things that most of them were eating. And these guys would come around and just entertain the guys for a couple hours. And I sang, had a fairly decent voice. And so once in a while I got to play girl singer, and I'd go along with the guys out into the bush. And of course I definitely was the object of attention, since most of them hadn't seen a woman in numerous months. So it was pretty safe. The guys were pretty defensive, but of my being there, but it was fun for me. It was a chance for me to do a little something differently, and so I got to go along with the guys once in a while.
Today, I'm sure if you did that, you'd have your own PSD, your own personal security details.
I'm guessing maybe so.
Yeah. So that's another thing. You played. I don't remember because I think we talked about this. We had coffee. I don't remember. You still play the guitar, but music helped you cope a lot. And you talked in the book about you had parties on the beach and the different things, and music and that guitar was really important to you. Music was really important to you. Playing it, listening to it, hearing it, it helped you to cope. Talk about that, and do you still have that guitar?
Oh, I still have the guitar. It actually was purchased for me by one of the docs at the hospital early on when I got in country. I had a guitar at home, and I didn't bring it with me because I just wasn't sure that was the wisest thing to do. And so one of the docs went to Tokyo on an R&R shortly after I got there, and I had him buy me an acoustic guitar, which I still have. I've played for many, many, many years. I haven't played much lately because my Parkinson's, it's difficult to get my right hand to move like it's supposed to move to play guitar.
Right.
And I keep saying when life slows down, I'm going to get back at it. So far now that I did the book, the life hasn't slowed down a whole lot. But music has always been played a major, major role in my life. I've sung with different groups and played guitar for many, many years it's always been a really important part of my life. So even though I don't necessarily play it right now, I still continue to love music, every bit of it, and sing a tune in the shower once in a while.
Right. You know, I've known a lot of veterans through a lot of wars who have said that music was a big part of helping them to cope. Matter of fact, there's a band that's four SF guys, four Special Forces guys called Bones Fork, and they've been on the show several times. And on one of those shows, I was asking them how they learned and everything, and they all learned while in the Army. Well, I think a few of them learned before, but then one guy talks about taking a guitar, one of his guitars or whatever, to Afghanistan, and he would play it whenever he could and in pretty austere conditions, and it was a godsend, and it really helped to save it helps them to cope, because music can really soothe the savage beast, and it can really help humans to soothe their savage souls sometimes. And the savage soul is really what you got to depend on to survive sometimes in a combat zone in war. So,
and that's really true. And I will tell you, I also had a 12-string guitar, and I had to quit playing that several years ago just because I couldn't do it anymore. And I donated it to a program here in Kansas City. I think it's called Guitars for Vets. And it actually went off to a guy in Afghanistan, and I got a lovely note from him with a photo of him playing the 12-string guitar. So I thought that was pretty cool.
We've actually had Guitars for Vets on this show. It was one of the guys out in California. Yeah, they've been on this show, and we need to do another show about music sometime. We need to have a show sometime on music and the benefits, and there's a couple different angles you could come at that. I need to keep you in mind for that. And the guy, the vet,
that would
anyways, that would be good. I got a lot of shows on the in concepts right now. I got a bunch scheduled, and I got a bunch I want to do. So anyway, I got to keep you in mind for that. So tell us about, when you guys had time off, you played the guitar, did you ever kind of little parties, did you read? I know you journaled. The journal had to have been somewhat important in helping you to cope. What was the body of, you had a beach right near the hospital, and I think you guys went water skiing and stuff. Tell us about that.
We did, and most people are, especially students that I speak to, find that so interesting. I think the most interesting part to them is that I used to say we could water ski until 1 o'clock because that's when the sharks came in, and I don't know how the sharks knew it was 1 o'clock, but they seemed to stick to that schedule. Yes, it was very interesting because, like I said, there was not much escapism from the war, but we had a tiny bit of sand Oh, and Bob Chris, I've got a great picture of him on the beach. I'm just thinking out loud. Anyway, there was a rickety old wooden staircase that led down from the Officers Club down to this little bitty spot of sand, which we called the beach. And although I have found since then, because I talked to some Marines who said the Marines were the ones that got the boat, I never knew for many years where the boat came from, but there was a boat and water skis, and some of us would go out water skiing when we had break time, which wasn't real often, but every once in a while. And so we really enjoyed that aspect of, again, once you were in the water, you kind of felt like you were away from the war for a little bit. We did have to worry about sharks, and then we also had red tide, which is this, you know, irritating algae that you get on the top of the water.
Right.
But most people don't expect to hear that we water skied, but we did when we had an opportunity. Now, I did hear that, and I just spoke today with a woman, another nurse, who said she was there about a year after I was up in Da Nang, and there was a typhoon that came through, and it wiped out the beach and wiped out several other things after I left. So I don't think the beach lasted forever. But anyway, it was another kind of escapism. But, of course, like I said, you know, probably it wasn't wise to do, because we did get mortar rounds sailing over our head from time to time. But we were young, and it was war, and, you know, you don't think about that stuff.
Well, you become conditioned not to worry about it. It becomes part of your normal. And the more you get mortared, the more you get rocketed, the more it's part of your normal. I got a question here. This is from Mitch Ashfield. He says, what is the one thing you will never forget from your time there?
It's very difficult to narrow it down to one. As I mentioned, I will never forget the patient, the young GI who was wounded. I will never forget things that were – I will never forget the monsoon rains and the heat in the summertime, because it wasn't something that I was used to experiencing, you know, on a regular basis. I will never forget the people, even though I don't remember everybody's name. I do actually have a roster with most of the names on. But there are – you just cannot forget faces. And even if you don't remember the person's name, the face will stay with you. And you can be in the middle of nowhere and see another Vietnam vet, and it's like you know each other. It's sort of it's a camaraderie, I guess it is. And that's something I will never forget. And I mean, I will be, and now that it's quote okay to talk about Vietnam, which it wasn't for many years, but you know, you see another vet and they'll say, welcome home. You say the same thing to them. And even if you've never met, you will never forget that camaraderie that goes with having been part of the same war. I'm sorry, it wasn't a conflict. It wasn't a, whatever, it was a war, and there's something you just, that when you meet somebody else who was in the same situation.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask some other things, but I want to move on now to talking about coming home, your transition back from Vietnam, out of the Army, and you took a trip. And
I did.
Years later, you've been back to Vietnam for a couple trips. So let's talk about coming back to the U.S. You get back in October of 70, and pretty soon after that, you and another Army nurse who'd been in Vietnam, you and she took a trip. So tell us about transitioning back and why you chose to take that trip and what that trip was about.
To be honest with you, I'm not sure why we decided to do it, except that I think we just wanted to get away on our own for a little bit. This was another nurse who I met while I was in Vietnam, and her time was up about 3 months before mine was. She lived in Minneapolis, and so we had agreed before she left that when I got back, I would hook up with her, and we would do a driving tour of the Northwest. So I probably wasn't back, I would say, less than 2 weeks. I don't remember the exact timing, but about that. And so I flew to Minneapolis, and she and I took off in her old family car. And we literally drove, and this was November and December, so there weren't a lot of bodies around. We literally went through North and South Dakota, pictures of us at Mount Rushmore, And through the Northwest, we got snowed in Butte, Montana. We spent a night in Cody, Wyoming, and ultimately ended up in Seattle and then Portland, San Francisco, L.A., and Vegas. And each of those places, we stopped and spent 2 or 3 days with nurses who we had known in Vietnam that just happened to be in those cities. And we drove through Yellowstone, didn't see a car for 70 miles. So that kind of brings you back down to, you know, not a whole lot of having to worry about this, that, or something else. And it was, I think it was a really wonderful way to return to the world, as we called it, but without the pressures and some of the abuse that a lot of the guys took, or people that came back to college campuses. And ultimately, at the end of that trip, she and I stopped at Fitzsimmons Army Hospital in Denver. We were both out of the military, but we applied for civil service nursing jobs, which we got. And so we finished our journey home and then went back a couple weeks later and began nursing at Fitzsimmons in January of that year. And I think it was just a wonderful way to decompress. You know, we drank a lot of cold duck, for those who remember cold duck, when we were in Vegas, probably more than we needed to be drinking, but we weren't driving at that point, so we were pretty okay. And I also had a little tape recorder and wrote some information down from that trip as well. And I think it was just we could be silly, we could commiserate with the nurses we knew and continue to share war stories. And I think that was probably very therapeutic on our part to have done that. And she and I are still friends. And actually, she went back into the military and went into the Air Force and ended up in a very high position with nursing in the, I believe it was the South Pacific area. So I think it was the right thing to do.
It sounds like it was. So, you know, in another part, in the book, you talk about how when you got back, you had some issues with nightmares. You didn't like how loud noises. The mm-hmm. sounds of helicopters made you nervous. Did mm-hmm. that trip help with that? How long did that persist?
Well, I think the trip definitely helped because we were not exposed to loud noises and a lot of, you know, whatever, probably until we got to Vegas. I mean, everything's loud in Vegas, but the rest of the trip was, you know, pretty quiet, just the two of us in the car, a lot of snow. But it takes you a while because you get some things that are so ingrained in you. For instance, the humidity in Vietnam always made salt stick in the salt shaker. So you automatically picked up the salt shaker and banged it on the table. And the first few times I did that at home, my mother said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, sorry, it's force of habit." And when you hear loud booms, July 4th, many times was difficult for people coming back. You'd want to, you know, hit the deck, crawl under the table or do whatever. Gradually that goes away, but it's not something you ever totally forget. I'm still jumpy, you know, when I hear a loud noise or something of that sort. It takes you a while, and you get used to certain smells. I was just talking with somebody a couple days ago who said, you know, there are certain things that I smell, and I'm automatically back in Vietnam. So there are things that really for most of your life will trigger different reactions in people.
Right, but the intensity and the nature of that memory and that trigger changes hopefully for the better and kind of is less a little bit terrifying. Has that been the case for you?
In most cases, that's true. I will tell you that, and I think I recount this in the book. People say, "Do you have any problems with PTSD?" On a personal level, I say, well, ask my husband because he would know whether I, you know, especially those early years. I don't think I had a lot of problems with that, but I did learn in 2014 when I went back for the fourth time to Vietnam that it's never gone because I was visiting the tunnels in Cu Chi down in the southern part of, was in South Vietnam, where the VC lived. underground for 3 months at a time in total darkness, you know, and just unbelievable conditions. And they've now hollowed out the tunnels, obviously, for those of us who are larger tourists and would like to go through them. And I've been through them on my three previous visits and had no problems. But the other thing at Cuchi that you could do is for $1, it used to be $1.50 a bullet, you could shoot an AK-47 or an M16. Well,
yeah.
The other times I'd been there, there wasn't much of that going on. And this time in 2014, the last visit, I had finished going through the tunnels, and there's also a display of traps and booby traps and all kinds of things. And there was somebody there who obviously had money in their pocket and decided they were going to shoot and shoot and shoot. And it was a constant barrage. And all of a sudden, I just fell apart. I started sobbing. I couldn't stop crying. And
yeah.
I was embarrassed because I, you know, had been there 3 times before and it never had bothered me. And so you just never know when something's going to come back. And, you know, you thought it was buried for good, but it apparently wasn't.
Yeah. So I got two questions, and well said. That was very
mm-hmm.
well stated. So I got two questions. One is from Rochelle Davidson, and she says, what is one piece of advice you would give a nurse today going in the same direction, situation? So I assume she's talking about Afghanistan
military.
Or who needs.
Yeah.
Yeah, military combat deployment.
I would say just know that you can't be totally prepared. There are going to be surprises. You can
mm-hmm.
do the best you can, and you can and have friends. Keep friends. Very important. Don't isolate yourself.
Right.
And if it means just hanging out with somebody, if it means sharing a book or sharing a meal or something, make sure there's somebody else there that you can talk to. And you just don't be embarrassed to say, this is way beyond what I thought was going to be, because there's no way to really prepare. You just have to take it one
right.
day at a time.
Right. Good. That's great advice. I hope, Rochelle, you got that. I hope you got that, Rochelle Davidson. Also, I got another question from Kenny.
Good luck. Good luck, Rochelle.
Yeah, good luck. Kenny McNamara, and Kenny says, will you be putting another book out, and where can I buy your book? And he is also asking about autographs.
About what?
He's also asking, Terry, my producer, says he's also asking about autographs. So he wants to know where you can get
okay.
he can get your book, and will you be putting out another book?
Well, right now I've got all I can do to take care of fill my speaking commitments on this book. Somebody asked me the same question earlier today at the book club I was speaking to, and I said, it's hard to follow a book like something, a memoir from Vietnam, unless I would talk about my Parkinson's and its relationship to Agent Orange. But I think my real passion now, aside from the book, is photography and poetry. And my husband and I have traveled extensively, and I think if I do another book, it would possibly be a combination of poetry and some of my photography. And in terms of where he can get a book, there is, I don't know how we do this. If people contact me via email directly, I will sign a book, and if they send me the money, I will send them the book signed. If they just want to get a book, you can get it on Amazon, or you can get it from my publisher, which is Deeds Publishing, Deeds Publishing. And they are
mm-hmm.
located in Athens, Georgia. It's deedspublishing.com. And if you just do loueisenbrandt.com, you'll go to my website, and that will put you in touch with my publisher. And if people want a book signed, they can get in touch with me directly, and I would be happy. As a matter of fact, we were just spent a little time in France a couple weeks ago, and I sent books off to people who gave me money while I was in France and said, send me a book. So any of those approaches would work in terms of getting my book. And you can always
okay,
go to the bookstore and ask for it, even if they don't carry it.
Right. Any bookstore will order it for you. But so, Kenny, go to your bookstore,
yes.
ask them to order it. Google and go to the Deeds Publishing. Go to their website, Amazon,
right.
Or you can go find Lou's Eisenbrandt. Go to her website. Find she's on Facebook. Any of those ways are going to lead you to a book ultimately.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit. We're a few more minutes. We may go over. Are you okay to go over an hour?
I'm fine.
Lou?
I don't have anything crucial later on this evening.
Okay, good. Well, usually the show goes an hour. I like to keep it to an hour because go over an hour just seems a little bit long. So, all your turn trips, how many times have you been back, and what drew you back so many times? I can't remember if you said three or four.
Four. I've been back four times.
Okay, so you've gone back four times to Vietnam. Tell us about those trips and the reason for those trips.
Okay, well, I knew when I finished my year there I wanted to come back because Vietnam is a beautiful country. And I found the Vietnamese people very cordial despite all the stuff that they'd gone through. I did not sense, and this is a personal note, I did not sense any hostility towards the U.S. or towards me. I know war situation presents itself differently, but I wanted to go back. I was curious. I wanted to see what the country would look like after some of the effects of Agent Orange had worn off and the people, we were not at war any longer. And I'm just a curious person. I like to follow up with things. So the first time I went back was in 1994. And actually, I was in a different job at that time. I actually worked as a travel agent for about 10 years. And we had just lifted the embargo on Vietnam, and they were looking for tourists. So a tour company put together a little trip. There were 12 of us, and we went back for 2 weeks. And the rest of the group knew that one amongst them was a Vietnam vet, and so they were very protective of me. I mean, every place we went, they'd say, are you okay? And so that was my first trip back. And I did not get back to where my hospital had been, even though I knew it wasn't there anymore. It was gone. I mean, it no longer existed. But I decided I wanted to go back to get as close as I could. So my second trip back was about later in 1996. And at that point, we had just normalized relations with Vietnam. So it was much more open. I went with a girlfriend who's been a friend of mine for many, many years. She was not a vet, but I said, hey, have I got a deal for you? I'm going back to Vietnam. Would you like to go with me? So she said, okay. So we spent 10 days there. We did not see another American the whole time we were there. So you can tell things have changed dramatically. But we did get back to where my hospital had been, and that was the closure part that I needed for that particular trip. Then in 2013, I went back, and my husband was with me as part of a legal group that we've done some traveling with. So it was quite different. We did all of Southeast Asia. We did Vietnam, Cambodia, Northern Thailand, and Myanmar. And that was a much more luxurious trip. We stayed in, really fine places. And I got to see other parts of Vietnam I had not seen previously. And then my final trip, which was probably the most meaningful, was with a group of students from the College of the Ozarks in southern Missouri, and they are very high on veterans. And about 2009, they started making trips to various parts of where soldiers had served in Korea and in World War II, taking vets back so they could see where they had served and what it looked like. And in 2014, they made their first trip to Vietnam, and I was privileged to be part of that. So I, myself and 11 guys, that's usually the odds, went back to Vietnam and visited each of the places that we had been. And two of those in our trip were former POWs at the Hanoi Hilton for 6.5 years apiece. And another gentleman was a Medal of Honor recipient, and that was a very meaningful trip back, and that's my last trip. I'm always open for another if one comes up. Those are the reasons I went back, and I thoroughly have enjoyed each one in different ways.
Wow. So in your book, especially at the end, a few times, and I don't remember exactly how you say it or how you stated in the book, but you convey a sense that you're still awaiting to be welcomed home, and you think that a lot of nurses feel the same, but I think a lot of veterans felt that way from the Vietnam War. Do you feel, mm-hmm. do you still feel like you haven't been welcomed home?
I would say I'm feeling more welcomed home by the ordinary person, the Vietnam, the vet, whoever, not by the military. And the reason I say that, and it just so happened that the book club that I was speaking with this morning, there was another nurse in the group who was in Da Nang, not far from where I was, but she was there a year later. And she agreed with me that we know of very, very few nurses who were given any kind of medals whatsoever. And all the gentlemen that I have spoken with, particularly in the trip when I went back in 2014, were astounded. None of us got bronze stars. We just didn't get medals. And I think that the military really should be faulted for that, because I feel, and the guys felt too, that just the fact that we were there and doing what we did for a year, we should have received some kind of recognition for that. I am very fortunate now with my speaking that I'm getting recognition from groups. The Daughters of the American Revolution have given me their Women in History medal, so I now actually have a medal. But I think it's unfortunate because so many people I don't know if they thought, well, that was our duty, was to go take care of the guys or what, but I think it's unfortunate that the military does not recognize its women like it should have.
Yeah, I wonder if that is still the case, because I don't know. But the military has always been very focused on combat arms, infantry, armor, artillery, the special operations
mm-hmm.
units, all those
mm-hmm.
people. But, you know, and like Ron Piper called in, Dick James, who I read you his email.
Right.
The brass, the Pentagon, the culture, the upper-level culture, may not recognize nurses. That's an interesting issue. I need to think about that. But all the guys, especially those guys that got treated, even those guys that didn't, I'm sure unanimously they would say, you know, no, they need more recognition, because I never heard anybody, especially anybody that spent time in any kind of field or mobile or whatever hospital, that didn't have just tons of great things to say about nurses. You know, like Ron Piper said earlier today.
I totally agree, and that's why I said I don't direct that at civilians or really at any of the vets, because I think they all, especially if they had to find themselves in a situation where they needed medical attention, certainly are appreciative of nurses. But I think, unfortunately, the military in itself does not recognize the women as it should, and that may be changing now because women are in many more capacities. But I think certainly in Vietnam, a lot of us should have gotten some sort of recognition.
I agree. That's interesting. And it's again, it's the culture driven by the senior leadership. Okay, so, we're a little bit over about 6 minutes or so. Did you want to cover anything else?
I would just say, first of all, thank you for the opportunity. I remember the day we met for coffee and you said, well, you know, I usually have several guests on, and I really didn't know anyone else at that time that was a nurse that could do it. And after we talked for an hour and a half or whatever, you said, "Oh no, you can handle this by yourself."
Oh, hell,
so I
yeah.
hope I've done properly in your eyes, and this was a success.
Properly, Lou, you've been great. I got to have you back on, and I've been really looking forward to this. I've been really looking forward to this and talking about your book and talking about your experience. And again, I rarely recommend this book, Vietnam Nurse, Mending and Remembering by Lou Eisenbrandt. Quick read. The style and voice is really great. It never bogs down. It's never boring. It moves. There's tons of great pictures. There's some great poetry. There's photocopies of key orders, you know, sending you to Vietnam and all that kind of thing. And it tells a really good, cohesive, coherent story without getting boring at any point or getting too pretentious or bogging down. I really recommend it. If anybody really wants to understand the experience of a nurse in Vietnam, I highly recommend your book.
Thank you. And so, I just want to thank you again for basically, maybe unbeknownst to you, but hooking me up with somebody I remember very well from the 91st. And I will be in touch with Bob. That's great.
That was great. Let me know if you don't hook up with them. I'll connect you guys. I'll make it happen.
Okay.
That was really fun to have Bob Crist call in and Jennifer Crist. That was really fun. And behalf also, Ron Piper calling in and Dick James, who sent me an email, and a whole bunch of other guys that sent me messages today saying, thank you, Lou. God bless you. And we love you, as in they all love you. And thank you very much.
It has been a wonderful experience, and I can't thank you enough.
My pleasure. All right. Well, this is Jeffrey Armadillo, Mother Forker, saying to all of our listeners now and all of our listeners later, and there will probably be a few later, and I'll send you a link for the show, Lou, so you can share it with other people. To all of you out there, this is Jeffrey Armadillo, Mother Forker, saying be safe, sleep well, out here.